Another angle of the Russia investigation, the social media companies like Facebook and Twitter, where Moscow worked to gain influence. Representatives from the tech heavyweights were on Capitol Hill again today, testifying before members of the Senate about what they're doing to curb the threats of propaganda online. Facebook's head of product policy and counterterrorism says the company can't do it alone.
No one company can combat the terrorist threat alone, so we partner with others, including companies, civil society, researchers, and governments around the world. Among other things, we work with 11 other companies, including those here, to maintain a shared industry database of hashes, unique digital fingerprints of terrorist content, so that we can all find and remove it faster.
Quoting here, back in 2004, when a 19-year-old Zuckerberg had just started building Facebook, he sent his Harvard friends a series of instant messages in which he marveled at the fact that 4,000 people had volunteered their personal information to his social network. Quoting here, people just submitted it. I don't know why. They, talking about the people that submitted their information to his social network, are dumb. dumb F's. That's what he called them. 14 years later, the number of people who have trusted Zuckerberg with their data has grown from 4,000 to 2 billion. Zuckerberg has also grown, or so he would have you believe. In a 2010 interview with The New Yorker, the Facebook founder said he regretted those early messages. If you're going to go and build a service that is influential and that a lot of people rely on, you need to be mature. And I think that I've grown a lot. I would like to agree with the 19-year-old Mark Zuckerberg. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 247. My name is Melvin, and I want to thank you so much for being here. So by now, you've heard about Cambridge Analytica. We've got some of the audio from the people that work for Cambridge Analytica talking about how they helped Donald Trump win the 2016 election. But I don't just want to talk about Facebook alone. See, I've talked about Facebook on this microphone quite a few times. And it's not hard to get me to trash Facebook. I have for a while. It's always bothered me the fact that they ask for and get so much personal information. And maybe I'm a little bit jealous because I'm not the one that thought of the idea. But it's interesting to me how easily people give up so much. So I have a profile over on Facebook. It's a business profile. I used to have an old personal one. But even with the personal one, I lied about everything from my name, from where I went to school. I lied about everything. I didn't lie about my birthday because I liked getting, you know, the birthday messages. It's easy, you know. For some people, Facebook is the only connection that they have with a lot of the outside world. And certainly there are people that I don't directly talk to anymore. I'd see their you know, come up on Facebook, it's their birthday, and I'd reach out to them and, hey, man, happy, you know, whatever. And so it's good for stuff like that. But what we're learning now is that all of the information that's being collected on us, and I've known how invasive it is for some time, because I can be on a completely different website looking at, say, a t-shirt, and then get into my Facebook, and I would see ad after ad after ad for that shirt or whatever it is that I'm shopping for. And I went, bloody hell. One day my wife was shopping for a particular product, and the ads for what she was seeing, because I'm shopping for such and such. I don't remember what it was. And I logged into Facebook, and there were ads for what. It was almost as if somebody was listening in. So now that we are in this particular place, I suppose the question is what we're going to do about it. So this article that I quoted from, it's titled, Facebook, Is It Time That We All Deleted Our Accounts? It's from The Guardian by Arwa Madawi. And what she points out is you can go ahead and delete your Facebook. See, right now, Facebook is trying to push people towards deactivation, which is effectively what I've done with my old personal account. Because what I'm trying to figure out now is how to not just delete, but download all of the data that they've collected on me, because I would like to see, it'd be interesting, I would like to see everything that they have on me. A lot of people have done that, and it's turned out super duper creepy for them, because what they've learned is that Facebook isn't just collecting the stuff that you post on Facebook. See, it's every single thing that you do on your Android device. Now, there was a fix last year. Android's been trying to fix it for years, but Facebook just kept operating under an older version of itself to sort of get around the rules that Android had about collecting information. But here's the way it goes. They were collecting your phone calls, who you called, how long you talked, your text messages, and yes, your pictures. Anything that was on your phone, and if you read through the permissions, and I know not a lot of people have, if you read through the permissions, you will find out that in the permissions, in black and white, not even in lawyer speak, so much of when you read the permissions, it's lawyer speak. In the permissions, it says that they are allowed to turn on your camera and your microphone at any time for any device that you have Facebook on. Phone, tablet, computer. So if your phone charges next to your bed, and I know mine does, but it doesn't have Facebook on it anymore. If your phone charges next to your bed, and your bed is used for, say, more than sleeping, just let that run around in your head for a little while. So the author of the article points out, we can go ahead and delete Facebook, but they also own Instagram, and they also own WhatsApp. So even if Facebook goes away, there's a pretty good chance that you use one of these other two apps. I use Instagram for my business. So, well, maybe we can just delete Facebook and we'll teach them a lesson, though. Maybe. But see, quoting from the same article here, there's another company that you've probably never heard of called Pixeneye. It's a software company. Quoting here, the software company Pixeneye, for example, is far from a household name. But if you granted an app permission to access your photos in the past, there's a good chance you've allowed it to utilize Pixeneye's tech. This scans the photos on your phone and it uses the data it extracts to create a story of who you are. It might characterize you as someone who watches sports, for example, or as a wine drinker who enjoys lots of family holidays. Your photo gallery offers a staggering amount of insight. As the CEO of Pixeneye wrote in an op-ed last year, our smartphone image galleries have in many ways become a reflection of our lives. Each image you have stored contains a range of data attributes and meta tags that not only reveal your purchasing profile, but can also be the key to predicting what purchases you're likely to make in the future. So you might be thinking, an app knows I like wine and uses that information to sell me stuff. What's the big deal? In isolation, not much. But as the CEO points out, when combined, data can reveal a lot. Bringing together multiple data sources is how data brokers have information such as personality profiles and relationship statuses. The more data points you have, the more you can predict. As the Cambridge Analytica investigation pointed out, even a few dozen Facebook likes can strongly predict someone's sexual orientation or the political party that they are most likely to vote for.
We have a very crooked media. We had a crooked candidate too, by the way. But we have a very, very crooked media. I will say this, folks. Everything that's turning out now, it's amazing. That's come full circle. Boy, have they committed a lot of atrocities when you look, right? Have they done things that are wrong?
That's a Trump rally from just a couple of months ago where they're still cheering, lock her up. Now, that's not an organic thing. I remember the first time I heard Donald Trump say, lock her up. He was at one of his rallies, rambling on. He hates blacks and all the rest. And somebody, he mentioned Hillary Clinton's name, and somebody said, lock her up. And he laughed a little bit, but then at every other rally thereafter, he kept saying, lock her up, lock her up. So one of the things that Cambridge Analytica has fessed up to in a hidden camera. So Channel 4 out of Britain decided to do this this hidden camera thing. And so they get one of the guys from Cambridge Analytica and they say, hey, we need an election fixed in, you know, oh, I don't know, Zimbabwe or whatever. Just pick a country. And the Cambridge Analytica people say, hey, all these places, these are all the places where we've helped tilt elections, where we've helped steal elections. So we can definitely help tilt or steal your election. And one of the things that Cambridge Analytica is responsible for is the lock her up chant. Now, the Hillary for prison 2016, that came from Alex Jones. But the lock her up chant, well, that came from Cambridge Analytica. And they brag about it on video. They even point out that they're the ones who took the name Crooked Hillary, which Trump may or may not have come up with, and they took the two O's in crooked and put in handcuffs.
Two fundamental human drivers when it comes to taking information on board, effectively, are hopes and fears, and many of those are unspoken and even unconscious. You didn't know that was a fear until you saw something that just evoked that reaction from you.
Right, right.
And our job is to get, is to drop the bucket further down the well than anybody else, to understand what are those really deep-seated underlying fears, concerns. There's no good fighting an election campaign on the facts, because actually it's all about emotion.
That's Cambridge Analytica, one of the executives from Cambridge Analytica, talking about how they get inside your head. So they didn't just come up with that. They came up with a lot of the slogans. They hired actors to be in a cage at Trump rallies and play Hillary. It was all kinds of things. And see, Cambridge Analytica, that's run by none other than Steve Bannon. This is another one of the things that Steve Bannon's involved in. And they were funded, they were largely funded for this particular campaign by Robert Mercer. Now, you've probably never heard of Robert Mercer either. He's another one of these billionaire American oligarchs that has given billions to the Republican Party to make sure that Republicans win. And so all of the things, probably right down to the names that Trump came up with, these are not his thing. I've watched Trump for years, and he's got a way of holding on to media attention for sure. But looking back on some of these things that the folks from Cambridge Analytica are now taking credit for, it's all coming together. It makes a lot of sense.
When you think about the fact that Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, but won the Electoral College vote, that's down to the data and the research. If you did your rallies in the right locations, you moved more people out in those key swing states on election day. That's how he won the election.
That's them bragging on tape about how they helped him win the election. They point out he lost by 3 million votes, but he still won the election. This has never happened before. Now, George W. Bush also won by losing, but the number was much, much smaller. It was in the thousands. This is in the millions. And so here's what they did. They figured out what states Donald Trump already had and Hillary Clinton already had, what states they could potentially win, and what states Donald Trump would need to win in order to bag the election, even without a majority of the votes. And so they were able to narrow down in each state places where they could find enough people just based on their Facebook profiles, based on their Facebook likes, based on the things that they said, all the metadata from that. So they collect all of this information from Facebook. Facebook's calling it a leak. I think we're going to find out that it was sold, because Facebook doesn't care who they sell to. The name of the game is money. And now that they're a publicly traded company, They need to make more money. So they would find out what your buttons were, right? That first clip that I played where they talked about finding out, you know, what they could get you look at and click on and get you going down the rabbit hole. So they say, well, Trump needs Pennsylvania. And to get Pennsylvania, you know, the polls say that he's this far behind. And so they take that amount of energy and they pour it into that state, helping push Donald Trump over the line. And they say, well, he also needs Wisconsin. And so they do the same targeted thing. And it's not every single person, but just the people that they're information tells them, that their data tells them that they're going to be able to swing or dissuade. And it wasn't just about getting people to vote for Donald Trump. It was also about getting people to not vote for Hillary. The Cambridge Analytica people were also largely behind the Still Sanders campaign. That was also their thing. And the Jill Stein campaign. Yeah, they pushed that too. So all of this put together, and you think about what a lucky dog, right? This Donald Trump, a brain dead moron who doesn't know his ass from his left foot. And then the Russians come in and they see that they can get whatever they want out of him. And by the way, I poke at Republicans a lot on this show and I say, what a bunch of dum-dums. Pick the dum-dum. But as much as I play dumb on this particular subject, I know why the evangelicals get behind him. Yeah, they all of these things that he's doing right now, if a Democrat were doing them, these people would be rioting. But they're okay with him doing them because he's a homophobe and because he's a racist. And all these other things that they tend to like about him. So they're going to get the judges they want. And they're going to get the laws that they want. And they're going to get the presidential directives that they want. So that's why they back him. And the same thing with the Republicans in Congress. These things that they've impeached other presidents over. That Donald Trump is doing to the 10th power. And nothing. Absolutely nothing from the Republican Party. And I know why. I think you know why too. It's the same reason that we get with the people. They want the judges. They want the signature on the bills that they pass. And so they're willing to put up with this no matter how much it dirties their party. They're absolutely willing to do this.
Cambridge Analytica was meeting with Corey Lewandowski in 2015 before Trump had even announced. Cambridge Analytica was founded on misappropriated data of at least 50 million Facebook users. This data was used to create profiling algorithms that would allow us to explore mental vulnerabilities of people and then map out ways to inject information into different streams or channels of content online. What Cambridge Analytica does is works on creating a web of disinformation online so that people start going down the rabbit hole of clicking on blogs, websites, etc. that make them think that certain things are happening that may not be.
And there it is. They find your emotional vulnerabilities. This guy is a whistleblower, and so he's been fired from Cambridge Analytica. And the Trump administration is trying to say that they may or may not have worked with Cambridge Analytica a little bit in the beginning, but they're definitely not working with them in 2020. So there's a bill making its way through Congress right now. The Republicans have realized that Facebook helped them win the election. Cambridge Analytica helped them win the election. And now they are in trouble. So they have decided to write up a bill that might help the situation. So Facebook is clearly a media company. They're unregulated. They don't see themselves as a media company, but they are. About 40% of Americans get their news from Facebook. So that, I'm sorry, you are a media company. And the legislation that I would like to see, and Zuckerberg says that he's open to this. I would like to see them regulated as a media company. But is that the bill that is making its way through Congress right now? This from the LA Times by David Lazarus, the headline. This bill would make it easier for businesses to keep their data breaches under wraps. Brought to you by the United States Republican Party. A congressional bill on data breach notifications is dubious for a number of reasons, not the least of which would exclude Equifax and other credit agencies from any requirements. It's breathtaking how far U.S. businesses will go to avoid the embarrassment, accountability, and possible financial consequences of having to reveal to customers that they got hacked. This week, a congressional bill was held on a draft bill aimed at creating a national standard for breach notifications, which would also include not just Facebook, but Equifax. No less troubling, it would exempt all banks and financial institutions and would require notification by retailers and other businesses only if they believe there's a reasonable risk that the breach of data security has resulted in identity theft, fraud, or economic loss to customers. No harm, apparently no foul. And hence, no notification that the company's system has been hacked. And the final result, the bill would preempt tougher state laws, including California's, thus lowering the notification bars for all businesses. The bill is titled the Data Acquisition and Technology Accountability and Security Act and was introduced by Representative Blaine Lutkemeyer, a Missouri Republican. It was also introduced by Representative Karen Maloney, a New York Democrat. Quoting from the article here, I get why Lutkemeyer is involved. He's chairman of the Financial House Services Subcommittee on Financial Institutions and Consumer Credit and is a friend to the banking business. Maloney sits on the same committee, but she enjoys a reputation as a consumer champion. She wrote the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act, which helped bring a measure of transparency to the card industry. Maloney told me her priorities haven't changed. She described the bill as a work in progress that she intends to incorporate feedback from consumer advocates. If you would like feedback from consumer advocates, they do not like this bill. So there's a lot of qualifiers in this bill, and they effectively let industry write this bill. European countries have decided to adopt a new privacy rule, which kicks in May. And it includes a requirement that people be notified within 72 hours of any unauthorized accessing of their personal information. No carve-outs, no dawdling. 72 hours. That's the whole thing. This bill is massive. And it leaves it up to the criminals to turn themselves in. It leaves it up to the criminals to admit their crime, which means nobody will be admitting their crime.
What is happening is, for the first time, really, people are digging in and they're checking out their data. They're going to their Facebook profiles and saying, Facebook knows all this stuff about me, and they're downloading copies of their data and seeing just how much Facebook knows about them. And when they lift up these rocks, they're kind of horrified by what they see. The story that came out here is that for Android users using Messenger, they actually had their call history recorded. And this isn't calls placed through their Messenger app. This is actually phone calls, texts that are happening outside of the app. They opted into the Messenger app, having this permission, but now they're seeing the record of it. They see the calls, who they're calling, the duration of the call, the timestamps down to the second, and it's very unnerving for people to see just how much data is there.
When it comes to Facebook's specifically, we gave that permission. Uncomfortable and creepy as it is, we gave that information without a lot of second thoughts. And so for the most part, we really only have to ourselves to blame when it comes to this. My concern, obviously, is one, the dependence, the deep dependence that we have on social media, not just as our entertainment, but as our information. It's not been serving us for some time, and now it has cost the American people a country, effectively. See, because we're not getting the things that we want right now. The person that's in charge at the FCC that overturned something that 80% of people wanted, we're not getting what we wanted. The tax bill that just passed, which is going to help really none of us. It puts a few bucks in our pockets for the first year or so, But then there are permanent tax cuts for billionaires and corporations. It's not for us. When Donald Trump promised that he was going to empty the swamp, he's done nothing but fill it and fill it with people that work for Goldman Sachs, the banking industry. The person that runs Health and Human Services used to work as a drug CEO. It's the exact opposite of what we want. There are some people that believe they're being served. Yeah, but we're really not. What's happening isn't helping anybody. But still, we seem to have this unbelievable dependence on not just social media, but Facebook specifically. And at what cost?
Well, certainly in their pitch, in their own company notes, they're quite boastful of the fact that in 25 years, SCL, which is the British partner, if you like, of Cambridge Analytica, indeed, SCL came first, that they had run over 200 elections in various countries. I mean, what made this sting so effective, or the undercover filming so effective, I think, from our perspective, was that we had two of our undercover crew go in and pretend to be Sri Lankan political operatives working for a wealthy family there, trying to get some kind of assistance from Cambridge Analytica to try and influence and make sure that their candidates win in the next Sri Lankan election. So certainly they are very au fait, by their own words, with the way to work, the way to win elections in lots of different places.
We tend to make fun of one another on both sides of the political aisle. Progressives will tell you that Republicans live in a world fantasy and vice versa. But there's a degree of truth to that with Facebook. See, because they need you back over and over and over again. And all social media sites do. And they do whatever it takes to bring you back there. Even if that means building a website which becomes your own personal Truman Show. And what I mean by that is you only see what they want you to see. You only hear what they want you to hear. And you only believe what you want to believe, what is there. And all the while, you're being watched and recorded. And information is being collected on you every minute of every day, even when you're not using Facebook itself.
I'm going to be as persuasive as I can. Look, we've seen the headlines the last few days with Cambridge Analytica, but the issue's bigger than Cambridge Analytica. I think Facebook's a fine company, but let's face it, they're no longer a company. They're a country. Their power is massive. We're in a brave new world here. I've got a few questions for Facebook. I want to know to what extent, if any, when we're on Facebook, and I go on Facebook a lot, we're really seeing a contrived world made up by Facebook algorithms. It's, you know, sort of like Truman and the Truman Show.
There's a saying that they have in the Republican Party. They used to use it more publicly, and now they just use it privately. And it's called working the refs. And when they complain about the media, they're working the refs. You know, when they say that the media is all liberal and all lying to you, they're working the refs. When they introduce talking points into our everyday vernacular, they're working the refs. And that's effectively what they're doing with these social media platforms that tailor everything to you while collecting all this information on you. This is just the new age version of working the refs.
Things that we've seen and that we have seen in the United States is the Trump administration's efforts to go after what we call the referees, who the agencies that serve as neutral arbiters in our democratic system, law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies, and the courts. Those are critical institutions in any democracy, and they're almost always among the first institutions that an elected authoritarian goes after in an effort to turn them, to gain their loyalty, to use them as shields against investigation, against prosecution on the one hand, and then eventually to use them as weapons against opponents. And that's one of the first and one of the most damaging things that, though not always successfully, that Trump is trying to do is go after to capture the referees, to bring them over to his side, to politicize them, and ultimately to use them as weapons against his opponents.
And the only person, and it's just one, it's not even an entire political party, the only person that wins this particular game, especially when it's played this way, is someone else who's pretty good at manipulating and controlling the media. And that's one Donald Trump, perhaps the Republican Party. And their supporters think that they're winning too. But I can promise you, none of us are winning. I can't specifically tell you to delete Facebook. I would love to. But like I mentioned, for a lot of people, that's most or the only connection that they have to a lot of people in their lives. But at the very least, limit what you do. Don't share what you're eating. You know, and maybe don't put it on your phone. Maybe put it on your a dedicated tablet or something so they can't take all of your crap away from you and use it, especially use it against you. You just have to rethink the way you use this kind of thing. It can be a useful tool. But for this host right here, it's hashtag delete Facebook.
If you look at other countries, I've gotten to know the leaders of many countries. And I won't mention names, but you know the countries I'm talking about. I go around, how's your drug problem? We don't have much of a drug problem. What do you mean you don't have a drug problem? Well, we don't have. I say, how come? We have zero tolerance for drug dealers. I say, what does that mean? That means we have the death penalty for drug dealers. We don't have a drug problem.
Quoting here, I got in a car accident and was in the hospital for 3 or 4 months. First, I took it for the pain as prescribed as needed. I started to like the buzz, so I began taking them more than I was supposed to. Then a family member introduced me to heroin, and I actually cried at first because I didn't feel any pain. All it takes is one time. Cassandra Blazingame from New Landen, Ohio. So Time Magazine is something I used to read quite a bit. I used to have a subscription, used to come to my house all the time. I've gotten into quite a few other media outlets, The Atlantic, The Nation, so on and so forth, because Time wasn't always covering so much of the things I was interested in. Time's taken a bit of a turn recently, and I was in the dentist office waiting to get seen, and I picked up an issue that said The Opioid Diaries, the March 5th edition of Time Magazine. I picked it up, and I was hooked. Soon as I got my cleaning done at the dentist, I immediately ran to the drugstore to buy a copy of the magazine, which I was unable to find. There were lots of tabloids, Cosmopolitan and Look Magazine and National Enquirer. So I hit another store, and then another store, and then another store. Took about 5-6 stores before I finally found the issue. And it stays in my house, and it stays out in the open. Not so much for my younger one, but for my two teenagers. And I've looked through it with them, and I've showed them the pictures, and I've read it to them. It's really well done, and it's not just a big, fat manual that's all black and white. There are pictures, there are quotes, there are stories, there are bodies. Some of the people that they profile in here have died already. Quoting here, it's not just a guy who's never worked a day in his life. It's airline pilots. It's teachers. I'm sure there's law enforcement and firemen out there hooked. It's Joe Citizen that is dying. That's quoting from Gus Andrew Teague II, a deputy sheriff in Montgomery County, Ohio, one of the hardest hit areas in the country.
But if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So Trump was recently in New Hampshire, and he was there to talk about the opioid problem. And it's pretty clear that he has no idea what the opioid problem is or how it works. Because he immediately shows up to this rally, which in all of his rallies are just political rallies. They're just places where he goes on stage and says lots of wacky things, and nobody's really thinking, and everybody cheers and yay, and then it's over. But listen, I listened to his entire talk, and how he talks about killing drug dealers. This is still a thing for killing drug dealers. We need to kill drug dealers. How the hell do people end up with so many opioids? Another quote here. If there was a terrorist that showed up in Montgomery County today and shot 50 people or 25 or even 10 for that matter, this community would be in an uproar. There'd be an army here trying to stop it. That's exactly where we are with opioids, but nobody is showing up. That's Bruce Langos, the executive director of the Criminal Intelligence Center at the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office in Dayton, Ohio. Langos, a retired executive, has been using data analysis to help local law enforcement address the crisis. So what's not being talked about when it comes to the opioid crisis, and especially when it comes to the drug dealers themselves, is the drug dealers are not guys in hoodies, wearing beanies, and standing on the street corner. No, for this particular drug problem, the drug dealers, well, one of them works in the Trump administration, in the Health and Human Services. He used to be the CEO of one of these major drug companies. So if we're really talking about killing drug dealers, we have to – who's making opioids? Who's pushing opioids on doctors? Who is saying that pain, human beings must feel absolutely no pain? Because here's what happens. And I know people that have taken OxyContin. And you take it and for most people, it's an instant life-changing addiction. I've known people who take nothing. They don't drink or smoke or even do the pot marijuana. But they got hurt or they got a surgery and they went to the doctor and they were given an opioid and then they were pulled off of that opioid. And before you know it, they hit the streets and they're looking for heroin, which is not only effective, but also cheap. Most of the people that I read about in this particular magazine, it shows them going through their third, their fourth, their fifth, and sometimes their last overdose.
I sense, and I certainly haven't talked to him about this, a profound misunderstanding about what is killing people and how it is killing people in America today. He made a big focus on reducing, slashing the amount of pills that are going out in this country. And of course, that is indeed important and led to the use of fentanyl, the synthetic drug that's out on the streets of America today. But fentanyl is what's killing more people than ever before.
Right.
It's killing more people than gun crashes or HIV AIDS.
This is really important to understand.
And so he goes out there and he talks about the idea that a border wall is going to stop people from dying of fentanyl in the United States.
That's not where people are getting their fentanyl.
The reality is, number one, most of the drugs that come across the southern border from Mexico, and Mexico is bringing in fentanyl, are coming through legal ports of entry, through places where you and I might drive our cars.
Right.
That's according to his own DEA.
Right.
Driving through the legal ports of entry into the United States.
It's not through the desert where the wall
is. Of course not. It's not coming through where it's not going to be a value proposition for the cartels to bring this stuff. And if they lose a load of it, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. They bring it where the risk is lower.
Yeah.
And number two, the fentanyl is coming directly to New Hampshire, where he is today, from China through his own United States Postal Service.
Right. I saw you doing a story where you were able to order it online.
You can go online. You can order it directly through the mail. So
you can. You can go online. You can order fentanyl and any other number of these incredibly potent drugs from China. And they'll ship here. See, we buy a lot of stuff not just from China for retail stores, but we buy a lot of stuff from China directly now, like as in me, as in you. If you use Wish or Geek or Alibaba or any of these, it's shipping directly to you. And now that there are so many packages coming in from China that are being shipped directly to people's houses, and yeah, they'll have tags on them saying that they went through customs. But did they? When it seems that the only thing that we can afford as a people, as a country, as a government, the only thing that we can afford are tax breaks for the rich and the military. That's it. Everything else has to be cut, 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 cut. And now, if you want to buy one of these incredibly powerful opioids and have it shipped directly to your home and get sick and die and overdose in your own home, from something that you just bought through the mail and injected into your arm, you can do that. And the thing that got you there, the thing that initially landed you there was you got to try it from your original pusher. I remember learning about this in the ghetto. I remember coming up when crack was just exploding. And I'd hear it all the time. I'd hear jokes about crack just because of the name. But then I would also hear, don't try it. Not even once. I'd hear that about lots of drugs, even the pot marijuana. Try that. Didn't get addicted. But crack. Crack was just destroying the neighborhood. And we'd hear about it all the time. Well, your so-and-so had her baby? Yeah, she had a crack baby. She had a crack baby. It's a baby made of crack? What? No. It's born addicted to crack because mom never stopped using crack. They say, don't try it even once. The first hit, they had ads on television. Even the first hit can be your last. It was this very dramatic thing. And we talked about it like that because it is a problem. It was a larger problem back then, but it's still a problem. And crack cocaine is still available and it's still a drug that people use. But what we weren't warning people about was the legal drug dealers, the people who get away with it because they get their authority from the United States government. And we're A-okay with them letting you try it, getting you hooked, and then watching you die because they are making a profit. They are the U.S. pharmaceutical industry.
What we hear often about is the death related to heroin or the death related to fentanyl.
Right.
But 80%, literally 8 out of 10 who use heroin today started with a legal prescription painkiller. Most often prescribed by a doctor or found in a medicine cabinet or given to someone by a friend. Almost all of it.
And then they move to either a cheaper version or they sometimes
they
move to heroin because
they move
it's
to heroin
more
it's much less, much less expensive and much more available.
Right.
But, I mean, literally, last year, this country prescribed enough opioids legally in this country to give every man, woman, and child a bottle of pills to be fully medicated around the clock for 3 weeks.
That's Gary Mandela of Shatterproof. He is an authority on this now, not by his own doing, but because he lost his son to an opioid overdose, and now has an organization where he spends his life trying to bring awareness to this particular subject so that hopefully nobody has to experience the pain that he as a parent had to experience when he buried his son. Quoting here, if your family member is struggling with addiction, love them. Don't fight them. Don't judge them. And for the love of everything holy, pray for them. And it's a lesson that Gary learned too late. But he's doing what he can to make sure that other people don't have to experience the same thing. But this is a problem that we cannot fix until we recognize how we got it and why it's here and who's afflicted. Building a border wall and screaming about Muslims and Mexicans isn't going to do it. Screaming about the unaccompanied kids that come from the South that are trying to escape the drug war in their company, that's not going to take care of it. We have to recognize the signs of people who are addicted. We can't make fun of people that are addicted. They're not the butt end of a joke. They're human beings. They're parents. They're children. They're professionals. Yeah, some of them are lowlifes too, fine, but they're all humans. And to recognize and be able to reach out to them. And we also have to be willing to fight the industry. Yeah, the guy on the corner is like, yeah, he's pushing something that's not awesome for you. That's not necessarily going to make your life better. But the guy on the corner is not the biggest problem. It's the guy in your doctor's office who's having this stuff pushed upon him. He gets you addicted, you hit the streets, and then you die. Or if you can keep getting this stuff, you just keep taking it until you die. Or you buy prescriptions on the streets, you move on to heroin, you buy the stuff from China. I don't want to make light of it at all. It's a serious issue, and we have unserious politicians and an unserious president. But this is one of the things that we, as people need to recognize what it is, because if we don't recognize what it is and how we got here, then we're not going to be able to fix the problem. One more from Mr. Mandela of Shatterproof.
Yes, my son suffered with this, but I will venture to say that of the 2.5 million people addicted to opioids today, or the 20 million people addicted to any drug or alcohol, every one of them, not just my son, feels stigmatized the way society looks at you.
Sure.
I mean, Allie, the last time my son came home for a visit, 4 months before he died, last time he ever came home, the last night we're sitting on the back porch talking about his recovery, just chatting away, and then he looked at me and he said, Dad, someday, I wish that someday people would realize I'm not a bad person.
Yeah.
I'm a good person and I have a really bad disease. And Dad, I am trying my absolute hardest. I mean, he was able to express it. How many people can express it? And that's what they feel. And if we could change the way that we think about this, you were right what you just said. About a quarter of the people in this country addicted will not seek treatment, studied by surveys, because they don't want anybody to know about it.
Yeah.
How many more people will seek treatment? How many people will feel loved and connected like they do with diabetes or heart disease? And so many fewer that will die.
The last time my son came home, the last time my son or daughter or... That's a phrase that should never, ever have to be said by a parent. The last time your child came... That should never have to be said. So we have to look out for them. We have to love them. And this isn't something that's just going to go away on its own. It's not going to be solved by a wall. And it's not necessarily going to be solved by the police in the streets either. It has to be solved in Washington. We need tougher regulations on these opioids. They need to not be given out so willingly. It's got to be a way to kill pain where we don't kill people as well.
Welcome back. Tonight, I'm obsessed with lawmakers who have joined a different kind of Me Too movement. In Washington State, the other Washington, legislators voted to exempt themselves from the state's Public Records Act. According to our friends at the Seattle Times, the bill seeks to ban permanently the public's access to lawmakers' emails, text messages, and calendars, even disciplinary hearings and complaints about the lawmakers' conduct. It's all happening in the era of Me Too. And guess what? The Washington State lawmakers are actually saying Me Too, because you know who else bans their records from the public and FOIA requests? These guys, the United States Congress, the biggest legislature of them all. So what Washington State is saying is Congress can keep their records under lock and key, then hey, Me Too. Well, this bill passed with veto-proof majorities in the Democratic-controlled House and Democratic-controlled Senate, so the Democratic Governor Jay Inslee can't do anything to stop the bill, even if he wants to. And the story gets better. Lawmakers made it impossible for voters to kill the bill through a referendum, which, you know, in Washington State, they do pretty well. And according to the Seattle Times, they're claiming their bill makes state government more transparent, not less. Boy, do you think that sounds a little fishy? Me too.
So this from the Seattle Times, quote, with breathtaking speed, Washington lawmakers passed a bill that removed themselves from the state's voter-approved Public Records Act, keeping years of emails and other documents off limits and making the legislature its own gatekeeper when it comes to secrecy. Senate Bill 6617, SB 6617, without debate, 4117 minutes later was passed. House lawmakers minutes after that, 8314. Legislators passed the bill only 48 hours after it became public that it even existed. Legislative leaders who would not say who drafted the bill when it came so late in the legislative session and why it didn't go through the traditional lawmaking process. After the Seattle Times emailed all 147 lawmakers for comment in anticipation of their vote, only a handful responded with their thoughts. They all added up to what Toby Nixon, president of the Washington Coalition of Open Government, called an abomination. The process just demonstrated incontrovertibly the utter contempt that legislators have for public participation in the public process. Jay Inslee said he didn't know if he was going to be able to sign the measure. Now, Chuck Todd said right there that it was passed with a veto-proof majority. It turns out that that part of the story was wrong. The bill did sit on Governor Inslee's desk for a little while, but then on March 1st, 2018, this according to the Seattle Times, I'll just give you the headline, a victory for the people. Governor Inslee makes the right call and rejects government secrecy. He vetoed SB 6617. Now, by the way, we have a democratically controlled government here in Washington State, and they went ahead and passed this thing. Yes, in order to pass, it needed lots of Democrats to vote for it too. So it wasn't just Republicans. It's pretty easy for me to go, Republican bad, Republican bad. But our Democratic lawmakers decided that they did not want to have an open government, and they wanted to go ahead and keep the things that they're doing secret. But even with that, I'm still going to vote Democratic in the future, because it was my Democratic governor that went ahead and vetoed it. We have Jay Inslee in Washington State, and he's pretty awesome. And this is not the first time that he's made gigantic headlines. It was stunning to hear it on Meet the Press. A little while back, after the shootings in Florida, the president, Donald Trump, decided to get all the governors together from all 50 states. But of all the comments that were said to Trump's face on that particular day, it was one, Governor Inslee, that stood up, spoke to the president, and got all the press.
Now, I know that you have suggested arming our teachers. And
no,
I just...
No,
I
no,
just,
not your teachers.
Not your
arming kids. A small portion that are very gun adept, that truly know how to handle. Because so I do feel, Governor, it's very important that gun-free zones, you have a gun-free zone, it's like an invitation for these very sick people to go there. I do think that there has to be some form of major retaliation if they're able to enter a school. And if that happens, you're not going to have any problems anymore, because they're never going to the school. You're never going to have a problem. So it would just be a very small group of people that are very gun adept. Anyway, go ahead, Governor.
If I may respond to that, let me just suggest whatever percentage it is. I heard at one time you might have suggested 20%. Whatever percentage it is, speaking as a grandfather,
right,
speaking as a governor of the state of Washington, I have listened to the people who would be affected by that. I've listened to the biology teachers, and they don't want to do that at any percentage. I've listened to the first grade teachers that don't want to be pistol packing first grade teachers. I've listened to law enforcement who have said they don't want to have to train teachers as law enforcement agencies, which takes about 6 months. Now, I just think this is a circumstance where we need to listen, that educators should educate, and they should not be foisted upon this responsibility of packing heat in first grade classes. Now, I understand you have suggested this, and we suggest things, and sometimes then we listen to people about it, and maybe they don't look so good a little later. So I just suggest we need a little less tweeting here, a little more listening, and let's just take that off the table and move forward.
All right. Thank you very much. You know, we have a number of states right now that do that. And I think with that in mind, I'll call on Greg Abbott, great governor of Texas.
Yeah, he calls on Greg Abbott because Greg Abbott's going to stand up and kiss him on the mouth. So just real quick, I want to finish with the good idea, right? Thank you, Jay Inslee. Proud of my governor, proud of Washington State, and proud I was able to end today's show on a bit of a happier note. See, they're not all bad. Yeah, politicians try to run and do crummy crap sometimes, and then other times, good leaders, true leaders, like one Jay Inslee, stand up to them. And that is all she wrote. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fiery Camp without our official homes, tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TFYCPO. You can listen all the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store for Android users. You can also download the shows from iTunes. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement area where you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to give an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are The Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail. rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. A special thanks to Kevin for producing it. Thank you. Listening is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, hopefully I didn't make you cry today. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.